Hello, this is Media Talk. I'm Matt Wells. On the move, the BBC tells the producers of Casualty to swim the Severn and head for Cardiff.
I think it's a big reshaping over time of how the BBC gets programmes made, where they get commissioned from. I think this is a big investment in talent across the UK.
Hands off, Auntie. The BBC chairman steps up the spat with Ofcom and bigs up Gardner's Question Time.
It's certainly true that in difficult times, a tall poppy like the BBC looks taller still. Not because it's necessarily grown, but because actually all the other flowers in the meadow are suffering.
And as Emily Bell speaks of an apocalyptic downturn in the newspaper business, we hear some good news from the former Telegraph editor Martin Newland.
I think largely as a result of what's happening in the Western media, this sort of wistfulness about what we were up to, building a paper when around us so many are dying.
This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Speak of the devil, Emily Bell, The Guardian's Director of Digital Content, is here. After your comments this week, are you ready to move out of London, Emily?
I think I'm going to have to. Never become the story. Whoops.
No, absolutely. And regular Guardian contributor, writer and journalist Maggie Brown is here. I can't imagine anything that will persuade you to move from Dulwich, Maggie.
Well, I wouldn't mind Doc Martin's house in Fort Isaac if it was coming my way.
All right, perhaps that's a...
I think it might be at a reduced price.
Exactly.
If my predictions come true.
That's
exactly.
True. All right, let's go first to the BBC's radical plans to shift the balance of power away from the capital. Jaina Bennett, the BBC's Director of Vision, told the Royal Television Society this week that it was her intention to move 50% of network TV production outside London. A high-profile casualty of the plan is, well, Casualty, which is currently produced in Bristol, but will make the move to Cardiff as it seeks to establish a new long-term home. I caught up with Jaina Bennett after she'd made her speech, and I asked her first how big a deal all this was for the BBC.
I think it's a big reshaping over time of how the BBC gets programmes made, where they get commissioned from, but also in terms of representation over time. I think this is a big investment in talent across the UK, and I think that leads to more different types of voices feeling they can contribute to programmes, whether that's writers, performers, directors, and I think it's taking advantage of what all the UK has to offer.
Why do this now?
Well, part of the plan was thinking about Salford as a big production centre in the north. But we really looked at what a lot of people were saying in the nations, which is every year is almost like starting from scratch in terms of programmes in being developed and being decided on as individual shows, and looking at the lack of returning business, returning commissions, meant that there's felt like an uphill road. Yet we have a commitment to the nations growing, because the representation issues, we want to improve approval, for example, in Scotland, but we also want to make sure we have a more equitable investment of the licence fee.
So
sustainability.
Yeah, so what you mean is, and what you're trying to address is, particularly in Scotland at the moment, there have been surveys that suggest that the approval of the BBC is not as good as it should be, and you think you can address this?
Approval of the BBC has sort of slopes off, I should say, from as you go north, so north of England and Scotland, our approval drops. Not the same story in Wales, actually, or even Northern Ireland, although we could look harder at where audiences think they could get more value. Part of that's to do with representing relevant things to people around the UK more and better. But it's also about an understanding that we're committed in terms of production as well to these regions and the nations.
How will you ensure that this is meaningful and that it just doesn't result in a whole load of producers and actors tripping up and down from London on Virgin trains?
I think that we want to have a look at how we get great quality, but also have some programmes in the mix that are help to unlock the sort of sense of place, more authenticity, sense of voice, more diversity, by being about the place they're in. However, it's also about having really high quality, and it's not like UK isn't like the hugest place on earth. People do travel around, and we want to make sure we have really great teams. But over time, when you have sustainable investment, you also get greater creative clusters that kind of, in a way, generate success upon success. Look at Wales with Doctor Who, Torchwood, Sarah Jane Adventures. There's more drama coming out of there. Now, in a way, it's because there's a development community there. There are writers who want to work there.
Why not move a so-called grown-up channel from out of London, BBC One, Two, Three, or Four?
Well, apart from the two top channels for children in this country moving to Salford, which is in, with their commissioning teams, of course, about £115 million of spend as well, and sport, and learning, which is also commissioned, and Five Live. We are moving a lot of commissioning power out. The strands are all commissioned by editors or exec producers who have that spending power. So there's a big devolution of spend going on because we're moving strands into more of the nations. But also, in terms of the channels, BBC 1 through 4, are actually news channels, another channel, and Parliament channel. Hard to move the Parliament channel, of course. But BBC 1 through 4, they really work very tightly together. The decision makers in terms of the investment in talent and development funding, for example, are the commissioners. We are distributing the commissioning teams more widely and out of London. But also, for example, the head of factual in-house across all seven bases is based in Bristol now. The second part of comedy commissioning, Cheryl Taylor, is based in Manchester. We're putting quite a lot of decision-making power out of London.
There's going to be controversy in the Southwest about your decision to move Casualty from Bristol, possibly to Cardiff. Why are you just shipping it over the Severn? You're taking out a huge amount of spending in an area that they would argue really needs it.
Well, firstly, there's a very healthy story about drama in the Southwest. Likewise to Candleford, for example, Mistresses, and quite a lot of drama is location-based drama, as opposed to the studio base of Casualty is in the Southwest.
But the studio base of Casualty provides the nub of the hub, so to speak, doesn't it?
That there's an argument that's the case. I'm not sure that is whether that really helps the other investments, to be honest. The thinking about Casualty, and we're going to look at the options. We haven't made a decision yet, but one of the attractions to the idea of Casualty going across the Severn 40 minutes to Wales is that we have this drama sort of city developed around Doctor Who, Torchwood, Sarah Jane, etc. And actually we can both get a better home for Casualty. Its present home isn't particularly good and needs to be looked at anyway. And so it's an opportunity to see whether we could have a cost-effective solution and better home for Casualty. But we'll look at other options as well and won't make a decision until January.
Jaina Bennett there. Some of the winners and losers were in the audience, so I got some reaction.
Eileen Gallagher, I'm Chief Executive of Shed Media. You probably will have guessed I'm Scottish. Been in England for 15 years, so I had to move to England really to get my company off the ground and get my career off the ground, and I don't want people in Scotland to have to do that anymore, quite frankly. And so I think the BBC have got to be really congratulated in this. I think that they are, of all the broadcasters, have shown a real commitment to this. I think Ofcom have let ITV off the hook, they've left Channel 4 off the hook, so it's left to the BBC to really make a go of making regional and national production a reality and not just a pipe dream.
I'm David Graham. I'm the CEO of a company called Attentional. I live in the Southwest. We would love to keep Casualty in Bristol. I mean, I think the facts are that there is a rather good drama cluster in Bristol, which is responsible not only for Casualty, but programs like Mistresses, Lark Rise, and also Skins on Channel 4. Casualty is very important to that, because it's spending about £30 million a year in Bristol, and when that expenditure then sort of radiates through the creative community. The benefit of moving it to Cardiff isn't obvious, because it doesn't actually transfer drama and drama spend out of London.
Alan Clements, Director of Content at STV. I think it's hard to see precisely what it will mean in 5 or 10 or 15 years' time, but I think what it will mean in the short term is a real increase in confidence and excitement that the BBC means at this time. It's serious this time. And I think, though there have been many, many initiatives, I've lived through many initiatives in the past, both in the independent sector and before, but I think it's clear the BBC means it this time, and that's what's fantastically exciting.
Reaction from some big names there. Maggie Brown, you were down at the speech this week. Do you think it's a good initiative or a bad initiative?
I think it's mixed. What struck me being in the audience was that almost it was like an imperial power sending out programmes to wherever it thought those programmes ought to go, regardless really of what the teams think. What worries me actually, and this isn't an anti-regional point at all, is that we're almost seeing broadcasting as part of a sort of social economic policy. And we all know, really, that good programmes are made by good teams of people, especially good strands. The casualty point is a really good one. I cannot see any justification for moving that out of its base. There is a problem because it has to be upgraded for high definition. All of the soap studios, including EastEnders, have to be. So that is probably one of the reasons why they're looking at it from an economic point of view as well.
But they could refurb it where it is.
Of course they could. And, I mean, the other thing is what is sort of ignored about the Cardiff point is that Cardiff happened because two very talented people actually collided and decided that they could do good business together.
Meaning?
Julie Gardner, the head of drama commissioning or production in Wales, and Russell T Davis. And from that has finally flown. I mean, Wales have been looking for this for decades, and suddenly they have this flowering. Interestingly, the BBC in Bristol is having this flowering as well.
So, Emily, Maggie thinks it smacks of a Soviet-style planned economy.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. This is where I just slightly disagree with Maggie, which is I do think that the BBC's actually got some social economic responsibility to the wider creative community in Britain. So, and we've been saying that for a while. So it would be churlish, really, to say this is a bad initiative. But I actually think it's a good initiative. I think that it's quite... you've had brave individuals before, like Kay Mellor, who's very much made Leeds her base and was very sort of passionate about producing regional programme. But they haven't had the infrastructure to support them. And you have to look at what's happening to ITV at the moment.
Which
and the
is
way it's
retrenching.
Completely retrenching.
That's why they're doing it partly, isn't
exactly.
it? To make
and,
a point
exactly.
about the BBC and, being a social force.
Exactly.
My point is really, what about the viewer and the programmes? I mean, I'm not against the move into the regions, but I'm also saying what happens if actually it doesn't work.
But if it doesn't work, they will have terrible programmes.
We'll have terrible programmes,
but I think it will work because I think that actually, you know, the diversity of Britain as it is today isn't properly reflected actually in the drama output of the BBC. They're going to continue to make, you know, their kind of top-line strands like Spooks, etc. You know, there's no way in which they are going to take some of those most successful formats. But, you know, we've seen with the Doctor Who strands exactly what can happen when it is inspired by individuals. But if you wait for it all to be inspired by individuals, you're never going to get growth in those areas. And I think that this is great sort of seed funding for the Russell T Davises of the future.
Maggie?
One point, though, is that when you think about the big success of The One Show, it was actually piloted and started and designed for Birmingham. They had to move it to London because the presenters and the bookings were not... prepared to go
yes,
to
but
Birmingham.
I think
and yet that's a hugely
but
successful
but programme. But there is a completely different point, I think, here, and I totally agree with you. And I agree, and actually, I'd transfer that to 5Live and say, I think, why would you move the live news radio output from, you know, one of the world's most important cities to Manchester, which is, you know, a regional hub, but it isn't where things really, really happen at the same rate and the same magnitude as they do in London. I think when you're doing things like current affairs, etc., you have to respect the geography and the economic kind of weighting of the country.
Yes, I
but I think, but I think culturally, there's no reason why you can't distribute. And in fact, you should do, because that's where actually you will start to sort of change the economic balance of the country as well.
What about, you mentioned the teams, Maggie, and already this week there's been some disquiet. The Telegraph quoted sources close to David Dimbleby saying that he wasn't very happy about the idea that Question Time would be based and edited and the production base would be in Glasgow.
Well, you know, he's had his say, and that's just one aspect, one big aspect of it. Of course, you could say that Question Time, when it's actually being made, moves around the country. So
it doesn't really matter where the editor is.
But I think the Panorama move is very interesting. I mean,
well, they're going to do more episodes.
I think at the moment they ship the producers out there, so and they do a sort of circuit. So there's an awful lot of things that. You know, could go wrong with this. Alan Yentob is apparently.
They'll never get Alan Yentob to move to Manchester.
Well, talk about moving house. He's got the most gorgeous Notting Hill kind of.
I should explain. I should explain. It has been suggested this week that Alan Yentob might become the controller of BBC North. But where would he go to lunch?
I don't know. There is a restaurant apparently in Newcastle. There might even be one in Leeds. I'm not sure.
I think the thing to look here though, and I was lunching actually with John McVeigh of PACT earlier this week. The five new commissioning editors in the regions, PACT are very keen on this because they see it as a chance now to actually get commissions in the regions from people who've got the power and the money to sign them off. And that is a very big factor. The BBC is, in effect, when you actually stand back, what's actually happened this week is that the BBC has disarmed a huge number of critics. And PACT is one of those. 4 years ago, PACT was saying, you know, the BBC wasn't even meeting its 25% quota. Now they're the BBC's absolute allies. And this is all very crucial when it comes to arguing about top-slicing licence fees,
so there's a political aspect to all of
this
as well.
There's a big political aspect to this.
All right. There is an interesting issue, though, that Eileen Gallagher was raising. She was saying that she had to move to London to get her career off the ground. And you know, perhaps
she,
this means...
She's got a very nice house around the corner from me, isn't
she?
Actually, I've moved to Finsbury Park, so I can't...
She's done all right for herself.
I think that's right, that there will be producers, and you don't know...
People shouldn't have to move to London.
No, and I think until you have the money out there, it is an experiment. Mm. Until you have the money out there, you don't quite know how it's going to change the game. But it's actually, you know, London is not as easy for, you know, creatives to live in as it was 30 to 40 years ago. Huge cost of living. And so I think this is another factor which is sort of necessary, that in fact you don't have a particularly great quality of life unless you're absolutely at the top of the creative tree. And Alan in his lovely Alan Yentob
and Peter Fincham and Peter Bazalgette.
Yeah, and they, you know, that it's fine for the top of the pyramid, but actually for the younger creatives, I think.
And we have talked about this before, and that it's very difficult for young people to get onto the tree unless you've got rich parents and all the rest of the things. So perhaps this will lead to more diversity in television. What do you think? Is this a meaningful move? Go to the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk. Coming up...
It's certainly true that in difficult times, a tall poppy like the BBC looks taller still. Not because it's necessarily grown, but because actually all the other flowers in the meadow are suffering.
Sir Michael Lyons there employing horticultural metaphors in defence of the BBC. Stay tuned for that. But first, controversial speeches are not the preserve of the BBC. Our own Emily here gave a speech to the think tank Polis this week, outlining, Emily, a pretty bleak future for the Western media over the next few years. You claim that the downturn in advertising revenue is endemic, not cyclical, and how many papers are we going to lose?
Well, I said, can I just say that this was not a speech necessarily, right. It was a sort of a talk, and it was a Polis thing. It was mostly to grad students at the LSE who were studying global media.
You thought nobody would be listening.
No, I knew it was, because Charlie Beckett was blogging it. Okay. So no. So I didn't, but it's only partially what I said. And I did say, I think that when you look at the cyclical downturn, which is the big recession that we're all going to have to live through, and then you look at the systemic downturn, which is the long-term rate of decline in newspaper sales and also the sort of fragmentation of advertising, the rise of the web. We have never seen anything like this before, and I don't think that people have really taken that on board in terms of just how bad it could get over the net. So I did say, you know, and somebody said, well, this sort of seems quite kind of bleak, you know, how bad could it be? And I said, well, you know, national newspapers, you know, you might lose kind of 5 or 6 titles. And they went, oh, that's apocalyptic. And I said, no, it's not really apocalyptic, because we've got 19 titles in the national press, and that's not counting the Evening Standard, it's not counting the 2 Scottish papers, which you can sort of, you know, factor in as potentially sort of national equivalent titles. And last time we had a recession in 1990, we actually lost 3 newspaper titles. We lost the News on Sunday. Nobody will remember that, but I do. We lost Sunday Correspondent. 3 or 4 years later, not actually as part of the recession, but part of the same kind of cycle. Today was bought by Rupert Murdoch. He closed it, absorbed the newsprint into his other titles.
So it's not unprecedented.
Well, the Great Depression, she says. Let's take us back to 1929. The Great Depression, you had very similar things that have happened in America. And the periodical titles sort of went from, you know, 3,500 to 2,500. You know, they sort of lost 30% of it. Similarly, you know, the newspaper barons, largely who were running, sort of, you know, people like Randolph Hearst were not necessarily making huge amounts of money during that period. The rise of radio was threatening them. It's all very sort of similar to now. And I don't know why we think we've been talking about how much change the market is going to have to absorb because of technology and differing audience behaviours. I don't know why we think, when we couple that with a really potentially quite deep and prolonged recession, why we think the market is going to be in the same shape when we come out of it.
So what are the titles at risk then? Would you care to rename?
I was sort of working on the basis of, well, if you that's about 25% of the titles, that doesn't seem unreasonable given the kind of rate of decline in circulation. And that's titles, not overall circulation. But you would have to look at particularly the titles which are exposed, and maybe not the ones you would automatically think of, but you would have to think about the titles that are either run for profit or that have shareholders to them. So, you know, if you look at the kind of, I'm not saying the Daily Mirror is going to shut, but, you know, the Sunday People, I mean, people have been talking about, well, is the Sunday People sustainable for a long time?
What's the point of the Sunday People?
Well, yeah, and you look at sort of Richard Desmond, he's got three titles there, with The Star, The Express, The Sunday Express.
But he hasn't got shareholders.
No,
though.
He hasn't, but he has run those papers on the basis of that they make a profit,
right.
And it would be interesting to see how he would react if they didn't make a profit.
Do you think, Emily, though, that there'll also be a contraction of all the supplements and the magazines, yeah, and the free sheets, the very purely advertising dependent?
Well, if you look at the papers now,
they're already,
you know, they're thinner, aren't they?
Well, the other thing is,
well, we've seen News International, for example, close down its magazine division.
Yes.
What strikes me is going to happen first. It will be this retraction, because at least newspapers have two strands of income. They have the subscription, the cover prices,
yeah,
and they have, okay, declining advertising in its different forms. But there are many, many publications that literally have been kept afloat by what has been an incredibly prosperous era.
Absolutely. Well, I think Maggie's absolutely right about this, because the thing that we forget, because we see the print industry as being hard work, and it has been hard work for the past 20 years because of changes,
yes,
in the market,
absolutely.
We forget the fact that actually for the last 10 years we've had an unbelievably prosperous market.
Yes.
And so again, this is all disappearing. Mm. I am a bit doom-laden about the actual sort of economic outlook. And so I think it's extraordinary that sort of journalists would react with surprise at this about their own industry, when you're living in a world where Goldman Sachs has been nationalised. You know, this is really serious stuff.
Okay.
And we're going to... So we're doomed. No, we're not.
Well,
but
well,
the other thing I did say,
okay,
the other thing I did say was that actually there is great sort of optimism, because there is a chance to change your business models, and there is a chance for people who invest in the right parts of their business.
And there is a flight to quality, isn't there, Emily? I mean, you know, we've seen strong figures from the Financial Times, Pearson Group. We see The Economist putting on sales, and we see, in general, some of the useful newspapers, you might say, who can help you navigate around these times, actually doing pretty well.
And they will prosper.
All right,
but there will be fewer of them.
OK, well, amidst this doom and gloom, there is some good news. The former Telegraph editor, Martin Newland, remember him, made his own out-of-London plan earlier this year by taking up the editorship of a new English-language daily newspaper, The National, which is based in Abu Dhabi. Now, our reporter, Oliver Luft, spoke to Martin Newland at what sounds like a pumping nightclub, but was actually a media conference in Abu Dhabi, and he started by asking him, in an era of caution, if there had been doubts that an English daily newspaper could establish itself in the Emirates.
I actually felt that internationally there was a lot of support. I think largely as a result of what's happening in the Western media, this sort of wistfulness about what we're up to, building a paper when around us so many are dying. No, locally, I think the National is quite a departure, and it may have made some waves locally, but Abu Dhabi has this sort of uncomplicated way of doing things. If they like something here, or you convince them of it, then everything is swept out of the way. No boards, no management, no bureaucracy, nothing.
Where did those doubts come from? Was it people sort of doubting that Abu Dhabi needed a paper which maybe had a sort of a Western lilt?
No. I mean, I hasten to add, a lot of the doubts were sort of self-doubts and doubts of people who, you know, who I persuaded over here. Was the country and the owners and everyone ready for this sort of a newspaper? And I think if you read us now, you've got your answer.
So how do you think you've been received from the public and from people in authorities here?
I think very well. I mean, I'm still here. 6 months, I'd soon know if I hadn't been received well. There's a refreshingly little amount of contact between me and proprietors, and certainly less than I used to get from Conrad Black or the Barclay brothers.
What about the staffing? Can you tell me where the majority of your staff come from? Is it a mixture of people from the region? Or
all over.
Yeah.
Some are expat Arabs, and a large amount are Americans, Canadians, Brits. Because of my previous incarnations in Canada and England, I was able to bring teams over, you know, people who knew you. So That saved us a lot of time.
Was it very important to have a team who you'd worked with in the past and knew you could, knew shorthand?
Without a doubt. I mean, we had to do this so quickly. People who can finish your sentences off for you are essential. And I had them from our previous incarnations. And we the great strength has been that we are technically strong as a result. But where the paper still has to pick up is in, because it's such a heavily expat newspaper, is in learning the rhythm of life here, the culture and things like that. So that's a slower process. But so far we haven't insulted. You know, we've got a hell of a lot of Emirati readers, local national readers. So we've got to be doing something right.
Well, perhaps if things go badly here, we could always go and finish off Martin Newland's sentences in Abu Dhabi, Maggie.
Do you like Martin Newland, Maggie?
I certainly do. I think he's one of the more personable of the newspaper editors. I mean, really, this is the Daily Telegraph in exile. That's what he's actually saying. Finish off my sentences. I mean, he's a Telegraph man through and through. He's just recruited all the people who have been thrown out of the Telegraph and given them a new berth in what sounds like a bit of a noisy but probably quite a nice place.
As long as you don't have sex on the beach.
No, I'm a long way past that. I'm still happy to go and edit Martin's websites for him.
All right, OK. Well, Martin Newland there was speaking to Media Guardian reporter Oliver Luft. Well, this week the latest RAJAR figures were out, and rather surprisingly, perhaps, considering recent events, the figures for DAB, digital radio, were looking in rude health. But, Maggie Brown, this doesn't mean, does it, that the problems for DAB are over?
Well, no, they're not. And, I mean, this is the basic fallout from the Channel 4 and the consortium decision, which you reported on at great length last week. The listening is of course, up because the sets are being sold, but unfortunately the most of the content is being provided by the BBC.
Emily, do you think that the government and Ofcom can rescue DAB now, or is it beyond saving?
Well, it's very hard to imagine that something which is providing more utility to users, and generally where people get the sets in their hands, they prefer them. It's sort of odd to think that you would row back from that and end up sort of killing it. So part of me, the sort of consumer part of me, thinks there must be a way to fix it, because it is actually, you know, qualitatively better than actually sort of FM in terms of, you know, kind of certainly sort of tuning radio and all that sort of stuff. But it's, you know, somebody's going to have to fill the gaps with the money. I mean, that's a difficult thing, is that either it's just going to become a sort of a BBC soulless investment, or they're going to have to sort of come up with something new from Ofcom, because I think that it isn't going to be funded by commercial radio, because commercial radio ain't got any money.
Remember, none of the other partners, I mean, one of the coup de grâces was actually that none of the other partners in this consortium with Channel 4 would invest in the services themselves. So you were left with really nobody going onto it apart from, I think, just one channel. So it is really, and at the moment, who is going to really invest in new media products?
And it's another headache for Ofcom, which is fighting on several fronts at the moment.
Well, I wonder if it's, again, one of the sort of the costs to Ofcom of becoming, as I say, an active ingredient in all of this, in its sort of mission to not just push plurality, but to provide a framework for, you know, the sustenance of Channel 4. And you think that actually it's kind of stepped outside its box as a pure economic regulator. And it's now sort of, you know, be careful what you wish for, Ed Richards, because if you really want a policy-making role, you're going to be ending up with some sort of pretty kind of nasty problems on your desk in the next sort of year or so. And there's not going to be any sort of money in the market to finance them.
OK, well, if you want to read more about the RAJAR figures themselves, do go to mediaguardian.co.uk.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Speeches, speeches, speeches. This week, Sir Michael Lyons, chair of the BBC Trust, was at it as well. He made a speech to the Broadcasting Press Guild. In it, he stoutly defended the BBC's claim to the licence fee, and he battered away any attempt to hive off any part of it to Channel 4. This is the so-called top-slicing argument.
Ofcom's own research, although they don't exactly make much of this, and Dan, I think you've been focusing on some the way they've used some of their statistics, shows that 87% of people recognise that the licence fee pays for the BBC in some form. Now, I think that is a very high recognition rate, and one you will not find replicated anywhere else in the world of public service funding in this country. It's a reason why the public has such high expectations of the BBC. They know they pay for it, they know how they pay for it, they know what they pay for it, and therefore they expect to get a commensurate value. Now, if I was naive, I might be surprised that top slicing remains an option. It holds next to no support from within the industry, and Ofcom's own research shows that 63% of the public would rather have their money back when given the choice over the how the current digital switchover funding might be used if it continued beyond 2012. That same survey showed that the next most popular option was increasing access to broadband, and then some way after that comes the possibility of funding Channel 4, and it ranks exactly equally with the funding of BBC's own digital channels.
So Michael Lyons talking at the this lunch that the Broadcasting Press Guild organised, and what was interesting was that line in the clip there where he was, and he was pressed on it later, where he was in effect suggesting that that Ofcom had sort of buried the results of their own research on top slicing and had spun it in their favour. I mean, that's quite a charge to make, isn't it?
Yes, it was, and I think it's part of this whole and growing belief that rightly or wrongly, or justly or unjustly, Ofcom don't appear to be as objective and above the battle as they ought to be. They've become a player. Can I say that? I think the key to what he's trying to move to is in his point where he says that 60-odd percent say give us the money back rather than give it to Channel 4.
So,
but then the second thing is all increase our access to broadband.
Yeah.
And what I think the BBC are going to come up with in the next month, in fact, I'm pretty certain about this, because Eric Huggers, who we the head of the new digital a new media side of the BBC, actually said this last week, they are going to say that we are here to promote and further digital Britain, and let us create a kind of national grid of super fast whatever it is, and that will also help the production sector and cut their costs. That's what I think the name of the game is, and I'm sure that this is what he's kind of trying to sort of lead us to, in order to hold off top slicing and in order to hold off any raid on BBC Worldwide.
It's very interesting that Emily, that if you go to the research that Ofcom did, the public consultation on top slicing, it comes way down the list of public priorities, yet it's still their top one of their top options.
It is exactly as Maggie said, and I think that, you know, this is sort of my point earlier about this, which is it just as Ofcom has gone outside its remit and it's become ideologically kind of hitched to a model of plurality in public service broadcasting, which means that it is championing Channel 4 over and above any other solution, and it can't do that because that's not its job. There is a real danger that things that we really need as a society and for the functioning of democracy will just disappear because they can't be funded by the market. And so Ofcom, I think, will have to be vigorous and active, but it's got to be impartial and it's got to have a very clear view of what its remit is.
All right. Well, listen, there's more about all the stories we've been discussing this week at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. I think we've been joined by Gareth McLean in just those 2 seconds of that sting there.
Sting. Amazing, isn't it? Speaking of sting, you'll never guess who I had in the back of my taxi. No.
I have hot footed
it from my... I've decided I'm going to do a travel log.
How are
you? Thought I could travel around America in a rickshaw.
Okay, well, this is
drawn
course...
by Stephen Fry, Simon Sharma,
and Griffith Jones.
Yes.
What is it about these shows? And this Stephen Fry one's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's very BBC One.
They spend about 7 seconds in each state.
It's like, oh, there goes Delaware.
I mean,
I don't know about Delaware. Perhaps a listener could tell us.
I don't know anything more about Delaware now from watching that show.
Just from that Perry Como song. You know, what did Delaware boy?
Yes.
She's got a New Jersey, you know?
Yeah.
I do remember that.
Well,
no, I don't remember it, but I heard it kind of years after it'd been released.
Perhaps they could sell little toys of Stephen Fry, like they're going to be selling Coronation Street toys.
I know. I'm quite excited about this, the Coronation Street merchandising. You're going to get, like, Underworld pants and things like that. It's very good.
So, presumably this could be extended.
Oh, yeah, well, they already do Betty's Hot Pot, which I believe you can buy in Morrison's. Other supermarkets are available, but because that's a northern one.
I don't think you can buy it in the south. I haven't seen it in Waitrose.
In the south. You in Waitrose? Yeah, we're a guardian. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to Roy Cropper nylon shoppers.
Yes, they would be good.
And maybe Ivy Tilsley rosary beads. Rosie Webster push-up bras.
You've been thinking about this.
I have. I've got Leanne Battersby Dutch caps written down as well.
Pregnancy tests, probably more likely.
Probably, yes. And
do you
I thought
think it's going to work though in a consumer recession.
It's a bit cheesy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
There's going to be an Emmerdale gardening club. Have you ever thought? But they keep like growing like hash and stuff in Emmerdale. So I wonder if it's like going to encourage like ganja up and down the country.
Now listen, did you watch this Peter Kay Pritton's Got the Pop Factor Celebrity Whatever?
I did, and I thought it was really well done. Mm. Because he'd obviously had a like he clearly watched it and all that.
Well, wasn't that part of the problem though? That X Factor is almost beyond parody.
Well, yes, as I said on my blog.
Shortly, I was reading.
Yes, diligently. I think it is almost beyond parody. And there were the moments where there were sort of acerbic moments, and I thought the Nelson Mandela Ella umbrella bit was really funny. But it was like 2 hours of television to make, and there was no point. It wasn't biting enough for me as a satire. It was just more of a blank pastiche.
How do you explain the fact it has such good ratings then? I mean, 5.5 million, are 5.5 million people kind of... easy to please or wrong?
Did you enjoy it, Maggie?
Well, I did in parts. I mainly watched it because my grown-up, my 23-year-old daughter and her boyfriend insisted on watching it because they'd actually been to the X Factor Live the night before. And we all sort of sat there. And what I noticed was that we kind of watched and then we kind of wandered off and made a cup of tea or got a drink or something. And then we kind of wandered back in and we joined up and we kind of then laughed a bit. And it got a bit funnier as it went on. Yeah. I didn't dislike it.
No, I mean, I thought fine, but I thought this has been Channel 4 have just like...
But only Channel 4 could do that show because, I mean, the BBC and ITV could not do it. So it was, in a sense, the point of Channel 4 that, you know,
they made it to keep Peter Kay happy. I thought it was really self-indulgent. And then there was that documentary in the middle.
In the middle of it, yes.
That looked like it being filmed on someone's mobile phone.
I didn't see it and I'm really glad I didn't. I'm quite bored just discussing about it.
Cheers, Emily.
I think we should move on in that case. What about they've decided to appoint Alexander Armstrong into the Poison Chalice? It's the Countdown.
I'm sorry, right, but why is there all this fuss about Countdown? Oh. Just watched by stinky pensioners.
You'll be a stinky pensioner one day.
No, I'll be dead before then. I'm going to go to Switzerland.
One of the reasons that Carol went was that she was far too expensive. She was costing them £1 million a year. So he must be quite a bargain basement.
As long as it keeps him out of crap dramas like Mutual Friends, I'm happy.
God, that is terrible.
But I think it's going to be one of those that he'll do it for one series and then the reality of doing four a day in Leeds or wherever will kind of kick in and he'll be like, actually.
Well, now listen, I want to mention that there was a picture of you doing the rounds on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
Another one. of you with Gordon Ramsay.
Yes, there is. Yes. Another one.
So the pop bitch stories were true.
So what's all this about? Can you explain?
No, I was cooking along with Gordon on Tuesday. I've done a piece for the paper on Monday.
What did you have to cook?
Scrambled eggs. But I managed to cock that up.
How did you manage to cock up scrambled eggs with Gordon Ramsay standing over you?
Well, he was standing with me, so I did get a bit flustered.
We look forward to your piece on Monday. Before we go, we should plug this RTS event that's coming up that Emily Bell is in. What's it called?
What's she going to say this time? Who's she going to upset
pitching,
now?
You'll like this, Gareth. I'm pitching to be chairman of Ofcom.
I think it's called a deputy.
Oh, yes. It'll be like McCain and Palin.
Oh, really? You've got the specs.
I think it's called...
I can see Channel 4 from my house.
Yeah.
I think it's called If I Were the Next Chairman of Ofcom.
It is.
Yes. So
I don't know. I need some ideas, though. So if you could all post on the blog, we can have a people's manifesto.
What's the next chairman of Ofcom do? What would you do if you were the next chairman of Ofcom, Gareth?
I'd put all of the BBC in... Falkirk. Okay. Everyone go. I'd make David Dimbleby share a house with Jeremy Paxman. You'd have to have bunk beds. You'd have to share a room.
In Cumbernauld.
Dig Cumbernauld.
Yeah. Can I just ask, why is David Dimbleby upset?
He doesn't have to go to Glasgow. He
doesn't Question Time go around the country? I know, anyway, how many times does he go into the production office that he's like really worried that he's going to have to go up north?
I'm sure he could log onto Skype or something. Anyway, that's it for this week. Thanks very much to everyone, to Emily Bell, Maggie Brown. Thank you, Gareth, for coming in. I'm Matt Wells. The producer is Jason Phipps. There'll be more media talk soon. Goodbye.